It is Friday, December 30th, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA.
Live to tape.
Oh, live to tape. It's the final best of the year. And, of course, it's Adolph Reed, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania, to discuss his recent book, The South, Jim Crow, and Its Afterlives. This was first aired on March 21st of this year, of 2022, and we reprise it now. It was one of the most highly desired, voted upon, nominated.
Requested.
Requested is the word I was looking for.
Yes.
Best of 2022. And so
and
here it is today. And rightly so. You will enjoy this one. Today's program, we should say, also sponsored by, before I tell you the comedy offerings today, because that's the way we're doing it. We're doing comedy. But this program, sponsored by my favorite sponsor, not just of 2022, but for years now, SunsetLakeCBD.com. Well, you know, when we first got this as a sponsor, I was like, I want to invest in this company.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know how to do it. I didn't have the money to do it. But I was like, these products are great. And the people who run the company are great. They're majority employee-owned business. They pay minimum wage of $20 per hour. They also use regenerative farming practices, so they take care of the land. They use integrated pest management, so they don't have any pesticides or synthetic fertilizers on their products. But they have a new hemp smokable, flower and smalls. Those are the different types of buds, I guess.
Yeah.
They're smokables. You don't need a promo code for this. Their new 2022 hemp flower is, their new cultivar is called Candy Kush. It's a hybrid. It's great for helping you ease into bed at night. It'll mellow you out.
I use the Sunset Lake for sleep, for sure.
Oh, my gosh.
It's so helpful.
Tinctures, the fudge, the gummies. They have all sorts of different products there. But they have this special right now that exists until Sunday night, December 31st, 11:59 p.m. You can mix match cultivars to find your new favorite. There is no promo code needed. All Sunset Lake CBD's hemp flower will be buy one, get one free.
Whoa.
Or fray. I don't know why I did that. We got to say CBD to avoid.
No, we get it.
But again, visit SunsetLakeCBD.com. Try these amazing new cultivars. Take advantage of the sale while it lasts. This is the time. Use 2022 to figure out which type of a plant, really, that you enjoy. Mm-hmm. And then 2023, dedicated, you're locked in. I mean, you can switch, but find out what you like. So check that out, SunsetLakeCBD.com. And, of course, if you use the coupon code LEFTISBEST, you get 20% off all their other products. And now, for the final program of 2022, the final offering of the final program, we're going to start with Adolph Reed, and we're going to follow it up with this kid, Peter McIndoe, with Birds Aren't Real. This was a contentious interview.
Mm.
I don't have conspiracy theorists on the program too often, but when I do, I push back. How could I just let them open field with this? So this kid, I raked through the coals.
Mm.
And I damaged him so badly. I think he moved to L.A. and then had to move back. He went to the hospital or something like that after this. But I really put the hurt on him. And
so just like trigger warning.
Trigger warning. It's going to get a little contentious between me and this kid. Peter McIndoe, if that's really his name, with his contention. He's from the Birds Aren't Real organization, I guess. So,
wow.
Enjoy this, folks. We got one more best of That actually, we have so many best ofs. We had to push into 2023 to do it, and we'll do that on Monday. All right, enjoy today's program. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland.
Oof,
I couldn't even get my own name out. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. I'd like to welcome back to the show after too long of a time, Professor Adolph Reed. He is a professor emeritus of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, author of The South, Jim Crow and Its Afterlives. Professor Reed, welcome back to the program.
Oh, well, yeah, it's good to be back. Thanks for having me.
So now, I was trying to figure out how to characterize your book, and I came up with autoethnography. and it is basically your, stories of your experience, living under Jim Crow, then making, observations and arguments arounding that in terms of how it functioned, expressing that sort of daily life under Jim Crow. I want to start with something that's fairly remedial for folks.
Okay.
Will you describe for us, like, what is, when we say Jim Crow, this is coming out of Reconstruction. And what are we talking about?
Well, it's really even a little later than Reconstruction. I mean, I define it really, pardon me, my allergies are killing me, as the social order based on codified racial subordination and the white supremacy that took shape in most of the South after the defeat of the populist insurgency in the early 1890s. Not even racial segregation carried the kind of systemic meanings prior to, say, 1890, that it did after. If you take, for instance, segregation in public transportation, Charles Lofgren in a book called The Plessy Case is really does really great work on this. That between emancipation and the Plessy Case, states and localities across the South, in some places, imposed segregation laws and then got rid of them and reimposed them. In some places, they didn't have them. In some places, they didn't have them and then imposed them and then got rid of them. In some places, they applied to trolleys but not to steamboats. But in some places, vice versa. So the regime of racial segregation, as we typically think of it, didn't become consolidated as a political or as a politically significant thing for whites or blacks on a large scale till the 1890s. So I would say I would delimit the Jim Crow era basically as having formed and consolidated someplace between 1890 and World War I, depending on where you were, and having begun to break down indirectly after World War II, and at the back of it, as I pointed, or the back of it, as I pointed out often, was broken by the time I was 18 years old, 1965.
We were trying to figure out who it was that we interviewed, who had talked about the coups that took place during Reconstruction in South Carolina as a function of white plantation owners realizing that they could not motivate Appalachians enough over race to break up the populists and, you know, I guess forming a political alliance with essentially newly freemen. And that they ended up resorting to violence there, and it is it your sense that to the extent that it begins to congeal, that Jim Crow laws were a function of that? I mean, I feel like that's a big part of your argument, is that it shows it is not that the racial elements of it in terms of intent or motivation were second order for an agenda that sort of precedes it.
Oh yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think you're probably thinking about North Carolina instead of South Carolina, because in North Carolina, in the midst of pushback against populism, a statewide populist Republican fusion government, what was elected in 1894 and then reelected by bigger margins in 1896. And that's what prompted the putsch led by the Democratic Party in 1898, when a few years later, former Governor Aycock commented that, you know, that we need the strength that comes from thinking all alike. And what that meant, of course, was all white people. And what that also meant was, what was the Democratic Party, which he also said, the Democratic Party alone is sufficient to meet our needs. But, and the fact is, And look, I know for most people in this country, you know, what happened before Martin Luther King, or the image of about Martin Luther King, was a kind of indistinguishable blur of the bad old timey times, right? From slavery to whatever came after slavery, which some people argued was worse than slavery. But I think it's more useful for us to think of the 30 years between, or say the 30 years after emancipation in 1865, as kind of a period of flux, or even if you will, kind of an interregnum, right, between two orders, you know, on which there was political contestation at the grassroots level, from grassroots level up, about what the reconstructed South was going to be, what the status of blacks who are now technically citizens in Southern political economy and Southern life was going to be. And it's also the case that the planter merchant capitalist class seemed in retrospect irrationally fearful of that possibility that you mentioned, right? That broken working class whites and blacks would align to overthrow them. And if we think about how, you know, what the upper class sense of being overthrown is today, the stakes are pretty low, right? Just as they are now, right? It was just as the likes of Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk think that having to pay taxes is like going on a forced march to Treblinka,
right?
Right. But I mean, they were kind of like that then too. So in addition to what happened in North Carolina in the mid 1890s, in Virginia in 1879, a similar kind of coalition was elected statewide and elected at the leadership, ironically or maybe not, of a former Confederate general named Mahone, took state power for a while in Virginia and passed a bunch of downwardly redistributive laws. But even beyond that, I mean, William H. Freeling's book, South Against the South, chronicles, the almost 300,000 white Southerners who didn't support the Confederacy and 100,000 or more who actively fought for the Union against secession. And the wonderful historian, Victoria Bynum, study what I did a book on that topic too. But in addition, she did the study of the Free State of Jones, which Gary Ross turned into a very much underappreciated film, but about a county in Mississippi, of all places, that seceded from the Confederacy, and where like an interracial army of white farmers and black runaways fought alongside the Union against the Confederacy. So it's not exactly that the governing class fears of this potential alliance were irrational. It's only from the later perspective, you know, after two or three generations of imposition of solid South ideology, that we might think that, you know, that all white people thought the same thing, basically. But the fact was that they and the populist insurgency just brought home to them that they really needed to do something about this once and for all. And the last thing I'll say about this is that it's noteworthy that disfranchisement happened after the defeat of populism. And not only 90% plus of all blacks were disfranchised, but depending on where you were, between a quarter to a third of whites were also disfranchised. And the result of it was that you know, the center of gravity of Southern politics shifted sharply to reflect the interests of the ruling class, right, or the capitalist and plantation upper class. And when people ask, and this is the last thing I'll say, but when people, you know, seek for reasons that say trade unionism is so much weaker in the South than it is elsewhere, you know, I mean, American academics tend to adduce culturalist explanations, right? So stuff like something about Southern culture or endemic commitment to white supremacy or whatever. Fact is, you don't need to look any farther than disfranchisement, because after the center of gravity of the Southern electorate shifted sharply toward the propertied classes, there was no space for the emergence of a governor, John Altgeld, for instance, like in Illinois, who supported the Haymarket, prisoners, right, like against the owners, right, or like other governors and mayors and councils who were pro-labor and that supported trade unionism. Because in the South, like, every level of government was totally committed to and owned by the ownership class. So guess what happens?
So the disenfranchisement that we saw through literacy tests, mm-hmm. or whatnot, right, or poll taxes, they disenfranchise black people writ large, and then basically poor whites. Mm-hmm. Who are and this is a almost like a rear guard action to sort of shut the door once they're in power. I mean, we
right. No, we exactly. Have, that's a good way to put it. Yeah,
we sort of have a contemporary model for this.
Right.
Yep. People are wondering. I mean, we're literally watching this. I feel like in real time. You know, this is right. You know, they get into the. They have the Supreme Court, and that door gets shut again to make sure that this gets locked in.
Right. Well, and look, I mean, that's one of the differences between right and left in this country at this point, right? At least, or what I often refer to now as whatever that thing is that occupies a cultural space that a left would occupy in the U.S. if there were one, right? Right, because the right has a vision that they're mobilizing around. And they want to impose it, and they want to make the world in their image, where the left has no vision, so we don't think to do stuff like that. But I want to say one thing about the disfranchisement thing too, or disfranchisement comparison too, if you don't mind. And it's this, like, and I've been hammering on this point in my classes for a while, and I think it's useful, for us all, to reflect on it for a moment or two. That disfranchisement in 2020, much like disfranchisement in 1895, was a means to an end. And certainly it was part of the fabric of white supremacy or the restoration of absolute governing class power under the sign of white supremacy at the end of the 19th century. But if blacks had voted dependably Democratic, by some percentage, not even a majority necessarily, then the white supremacists or the reimposition of absolute class power under the sign of white supremacy would probably have happened anyway, but it's less likely that disfranchisement, what would have been one of its principal weapons, right? And by the same token now, and I just wrote something about this with respect to Nikki Haley, the former governor of South Carolina. She's gotten quite huffy when people in South Carolina have suggested that there's a racial motive that underlies their attempts to purify the electorate and to suppress voting. And I'm sure that she's sincere, at least in the sense that people believe what they need to believe to do what they need to get done. But she could be sincere in another more plausible sense, too, in that it's easy to see that now, and a lot of Republicans would say this themselves, including Haley, she's shown it, that if more black people voted Republican, disfranchisement wouldn't, or that kind of disfranchisement, racialized disfranchisement, wouldn't necessarily be the mechanism of choice to close the door and to lock in class power now. So what's my point there? Well, my point there is that, as I said about the Jim Crow South, while on one level, obviously and clearly, indisputably, race was and racism was what drove the Jim Crow order, but on another level, it really wasn't about race at all.
Okay, so if I understand you, it's that the disenfranchisement would not be the arrow if black people voted for Republicans. Now they're not going to,
right,
in the numbers that they want, but
right,
it, the fact that it's really just like, how do we maintain power? And this
right
is the low hanging fruit. It is
right. No, that's right.
And it's also the, and I want to actually get into, some of the aspects of the book, but in a moment, mm-hmm, but this is sort of, I guess, surrounds it too. I mean, I just read it's also sort of, that utility is also there to fight that disenfranchisement. Franchisement. In other words, I just read, I have a headline in Texas, where they've instituted this sort of mail-in ballot,
right,
they've changed the laws, and the spoiled vote tally has gone from like 1% to like 30%.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they're also finding a racial gap here.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that headline, without the racial gap, it doesn't seem to gain as much traction,
mm-hmm,
as the one with the racial gap. But it's still
right
equally anti-democratic.
Right.
Small
right
D.
That's right.
And
right
it's still extremely problematic, and it's still going to empower the Republicans in their agenda. But part of it is that, like, we didn't have a 1965 for white people. Women had
right
their vote,
right,
20, 30, 40 years earlier. And so it doesn't have the same resonance to just say, like, hey, wait a second, there's clearly voter disenfranchisement here.
Right.
But without the sort of racial, it doesn't resonate in the same way. And it's just sort of like, this is just the easiest way for them to do it. I mean, I think there was a guy caught on camera by, I think, like, the Daily Show, a North Carolina official who was like,
right,
yeah, well, of course, we did that because we didn't
right
want the black people to vote. And it's because, they're Democrats.
Right. There's one of the morons, like, in North Carolina actually wrote to the Justice Department and asked for a list of precincts where blacks predominated. And then they produced a redistricting plan that disfranchised all those precincts. So it was so transparent there. It's too stupid to live, basically. But I see where you're going with this. And look, I mean, this is part of the Catch-22, man. I agree. In the midst of the street fight, you pick up whatever's around that you can use, right? But again, this takes us back to the problem that I mentioned at the beginning, that the right has some place that they're trying to go. So they will make use of the low-hanging fruit, but they'll connect that in one way or another, in whatever ways, mainly through the through the improvisational dynamics of coalition formation. They'll connect that to this strategy for getting to where they want to get ultimately, right? And you put your thumb on the problem too, that the only language that we have legally to protest inequality is a language based on what I've described as categories of ascriptive difference, like categories based on what you supposedly are instead of what you do. So race, gender, sexual orientation, et cetera. And that kind of feeds the disparitarian understanding of what inequality is, right? But that all depends on, or the success of that approach depends not on building a broad political alliance to challenge for power, but it depends on appellants having the ear of the sympathetic voices in the ruling class, in the courts, in Congress, or whatever, who can make things happen, you know, outside of a majoritarian context. And we can't, you know, we haven't been able to depend on that for 30 years, right? And we certainly can't now. And that's why I think that part of what has to happen, and this is what, pardon the shameless plug, but our podcast, classmatters.org, or the Class Matters podcast, is focused on, our tagline is, what would the country look like if it were governed by and for the working class? And we're trying to find ways to start, you know, getting around the identitarian, you know, roadblocks, and sort of catching working people before they get drawn into Trumpism, basically. And that's what we've got to do.
Yeah. Do you feel like, I mean, the flattening, I guess, of that, those power dynamics exacerbates or even worsens, you know, some of the ways that the right has been able to make gains with voter suppression, like in this current day? I mean, I know that the history of it might be part of, you know, why it's such an uphill battle right now.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. That's what do you mean by flattening of the power dynamics?
Yeah, just like making it, you know, more only about anti-racism.
Oh, yeah.
The class, right.
Yeah. I think absolutely. And in fact, a good friend and colleague of mine in South Carolina and I did an article. He did most of the work, actually, a few years ago on this. After working in South Carolina for a long time and noticing that Democrats and Republicans, black and white, are equally committed to race being the central fault line for political differentiation in the state, my colleague, the professor Willie Leggett, who, I mean, by the way, like if there were a Nobel Prize for apathems, he would have won it for saying a few years ago that the only thing that hasn't changed about black politics since 1965 is how we think about it. And he's absolutely correct about that. But like he went back to V.O. Key's classic study of Southern politics in 1949 called Southern Politics in State and Nation, and found the pages where Key describes the role that race played in South Carolina politics in 1949. And what we figured out was with a very small handful of individual word changes, right? In those passages, you could say just about the same thing about South Carolina race in South Carolina politics now, that it's used as what the Field Sisters call the surface camouflage to conceal the political, economic, and class dynamics that are really driving driving the society. And I think that's true nationally. And, you know, like for something else I was just trying to work on, I was stunned to find out that apparently the Census Bureau stopped keeping records on labor force participation by race at some point before 2020. So it's just all about, and And even when you look at local economic data, under the economy, what you see is like businesses. But you got to do some extra digging around to find out anything about employment. So this is like part of a bipartisan program, basically, to make the working class disappear. It's also part of the contemporary anti-racist program, right? I mean, since 2016, the black chattering class and as best exemplified by Joanne Reed, like on MSNBC, has been insisting that working class is a euphemism for white racist, which means, among other things, you can't be black and be in a working class. You can only be black. And to the extent that the so-called black agenda is set by the investor class, well, we kind of see how that plays out, don't we? Right. That's where the wealth gap comes from, despite the fact that we know that 3/4 of so-called black wealth is held by the 10% or the richest 10% of black people, and 3/4 of so-called white wealth is held by the richest 10% of white people, and the bottom half of blacks and whites have no wealth whatsoever, and 96% of black wealth is held by the richest 20% of black people. So what does narrowing the wealth gap do for anybody who has to work for a living? So yeah, like it's from all around us, right? And that's the reason that my colleagues and I have been describing anti-racist discourse as a species of neoliberalism at this point.
I mean, it's interesting. The I don't know if it's the irony, but the it's certainly not a coincidence, maybe. But the when you talk about Joanne Reed or any mm-hmm. folks who are using, you know, who perceive the working class as just white supremacists, it excludes black working class people. It also happens on the other side, I think, where people are arguing, like, you know, you have some people who are arguing Democrats need to appeal more to the working class.
Right.
Some of those people are basically just also, it seems to me, erasing black working class people.
Right.
It's a project that really brings people together, I guess.
I tell you, that's like a throwback. That's a very important point too, Sam. And that's like a throwback to that moment at the end of the 80s and the beginning of the 90s when in the earlier incarnation of Clintonism, right, a chunk of the driving line was that the Democrats needed to get away from, you know, from their association with minorities, labor, and feminists, right? And this is just another version of the same thing. So, yeah, there's a Scylla and a Charybdis out there, and we have to navigate very carefully through the strait between them.
Well, because you did say identitarian roadblocks, and is that mm-hmm. what you mean there? That this is just like it's a distraction or it's a misdirection on some level, and we can't address the underlying sort of, or we can't even see necessarily the underlying dynamic if
right.
we. Because we're making some type of category error, I guess, in terms of like
yes.
what is driving.
Yes, I would say that. And I would also say that burned into my brain is the image of, what's his name? Van Jones falling to his knees and weeping when he got that $100 million check from Jeff Bezos, right? I mean, this is a class program, right? It's a class politics that's dressed up as a race politics, which is what race politics always is. It was late 19th century white supremacy was a class politics dressed up as a race politics. Early 21st century anti-racist politics is a different kind of class politics dressed up as a different kind of race politics.
So where does, and I,
like how we're naming names on the show today.
Oh, well, yeah, it's all right. I mean, you know, like I distinctly
Oh, I'm
remember,
old. That's what old people do. So I'm just channeling my grandmother.
Van Jones once. I remember this very distinctly because I did it in my basement. It was just when this was an audio show only. And he had just spoken at Netroots Nation. This must have been 10 years ago or 8 years ago. And it was developing he wanted to create a group to fight like the Tea Party. Mm, he was sort of okay. in a stage where he was challenging Glenn Beck. And I remember distinctly asking him, like, okay, so who's the enemy here? Like, I mean, who is doing, there is no enemy. Right. I think is what he said. And I was just like, wait, what? Yeah. How do you, what? This is all just sort of like the weather. Like, I don't understand.
Well, I tell you what, man, like when I worked in Manhattan and lived partly in New Haven, every day on your Metro North in Stamford or between Stamford and Greenwich, I would ride past on a train, the world, headquarters of WWE, the World Wrestling Enterprise. And that's what that politics is to me. But that's what Van Jones, debating Glenn Beck is, basically. It's theater.
Well, but let me speak in defense of WWE.
Well, in fact, they should have debated in Jell-O.
That's part of, frankly, that's part of what we do here is partly that element. But like, at the very least, do it well, in my estimation. Right. Like, there has to be some value to it. If you're not, all he's doing is fighting Glenn Beck. He's not fighting what Glenn Beck stands for is problematic. That was my issue with it. Like,
right. I hear you.
I don't mind the theater. I do also remember one time I was on a program where I was sitting next to a guy who I only knew him as a fundraiser for Obama. And we got into a big argument about the estate tax. And he was saying like the estate tax is hindering intergenerational wealth transfer.
Oh my God.
People. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And we got into like this.
Oh
this
my
big,
God!
Retracted argument that happened, and he's like the Congressional Black Caucus supports it, and we're arguing. I'm like, I don't care who supports it. It's ridiculous. We're arguing through the commercial break, and it wasn't until afterwards when I got home that I Googled the guy and found out that he was like number one or two like wealthiest black men in the entire country. Like he was worried about his kids getting the full, like, you know, like they're going to lose out on, they're only going to get like 30 or 50 million each in, you know, if these taxes go through. And I was just like, wow. All right. Well, so you write that there's like almost like two opposite misunderstandings of Jim Crow to get back into this, because this is, what were they or what are they?
Well, yeah, one is the happy faced one, right? That it solved all of our problems and there's no more inequality or that's unjust anymore, right?
The end of Jim Crow. Okay.
Right. And the other is that the victories didn't amount to anything, right? That they didn't mean anything. And I've been hearing the latter line pop up, especially among young people, because young people don't know anything, but they think they know a whole lot. For 30 years now, and my knee-jerk reaction has always been, God, I wish I had a Wayback Machine, and I could drop you like in the Mississippi Delta in 1950, and then come back 6 weeks later and pick you up, right? So there's that kind of misunderstanding, and the other misunderstanding. I guess is more, or is either more naive or naive in a different way, but it stems from partly from a fundamental misunderstanding of the roots of inequality, even those inequalities that manifest as racial, right? And my friend, the historian Barbara Jean Fields, has often said that. For a long time now, the way that people in this country talk about slavery or Jim Crow, one would think that the point was to produce racism, right? Not, cotton and rice and sugarcane, right? So we've kind of inverted the understanding of the relation between racial bigotry and the social order out of which racial bigotry emerges and makes sense. And I think one of the things I try to convey in the book is that it is that race is an ideology. It's not a thing, of course. It's historically specific. It comes into existence in certain historical moments and political economic contexts. And while the word stays pretty much the same, the content that attaches to the word changes, right, over time. And race or racism fundamentally cannot cause anything because they're abstract ideas that don't have the capacity to make anything happen, right? What the ideologies appeal to people because they emerge out of a sort of common sense cauldron, right? But such that you look around and see who is positioned where on the social hierarchy, and race is a taxonomic discourse that provides a natural seeming explanation for why who is wherever they are should be there, right? It's supposed to be there. And like all such ideologies, it gains currency and becomes dominant when it comports with the sensibilities of powerful interests, right, in the society who want to propagate it and use it.
If racism did not provide the desired outcome by wealthy people, they would move on to something else.
Totally.
Okay, so here's my dilemma, and then I can bring it back to Jim Crow.
Oh yeah, sure.
But here's I subscribe to that notion, and in some ways I think everybody a lot of anti-racists do too and don't necessarily realize. I mean, because you always hear like nobody's born racist; you're taught to be racist.
Right.
Well, if that's the case, the question is like why, and and if it's not endemic, the question is like why are you being taught to be racist? And it is, it may on the micro level have be like, well, it's a tradition in our family. Mm-hmm. You know, we like to be racist. But somebody was taught to be racist, and it was used as a tool. Mm-hmm. But does that mean? But it doesn't necessarily follow that if racism is taught to be a tool, that you can bypass the implications of that belief system that has now been reproduced for the benefit of maintaining a power dynamic that has to do with money and class.
Right.
Does it necessarily follow that you can bypass that and just deal directly with power in terms of money and class?
Or
do you need to sort of like go back in, like almost like, you know, I turn my shirt inside out. I gotta turn it back inside in before I can put it on.
Well, I know that's what a lot of anti-racist educators and like others say, a lot of anti-racist activists, what somebody I read not that long ago said that, you know, our job is as progressive activists or as leftists is to win white people to the understanding of how they've messed over black people. And that's but the question that you ask really gets down to an organizing question, right? And I think that you kind of split the difference between the two approaches that you suggest, right? That is to build a broad alliance, right? Well, it's like trying to organize a shop, basically, right? That you start out from the issues and concerns that people have in common, right? And through the course of struggling to advance those issues and concerns, both in a positive sense and, of course, in a negative one too, that then you build the kinds of solidarities that make it easier to confront directly the vestiges or the more than vestiges, the actual bigoted sensibilities that individual people have. And I mean, a couple things about that. One is that's an approach that doesn't begin from the assumption that to build a movement, you got to turn people into saints first, basically. As I've often said, it's not like we're trying to pledge a frat here, right? Or to rush a frat, like we're trying to. So we don't need everybody to believe the same thing coming in, right? The point is that through the course of building and broadening the struggle, people come to see things differently. And like, this is the petty comparison, I suppose. Some people might think it's kind of romantic, but I mentioned this at least once or twice in the book, that at this point, right, for the last 30 years, right, I have noticed, I've sometimes registered, when I see interracial groups of people out in the South, friends, coworkers, neighbors, whatever, you know, having drinks at a TGI Fridays or a softball game together, you know, I recall that this is a level of sort of almost trivial but mundane interaction that would not have been possible as early or as late as 1960, at least. And that was partly the point of Jim Crow. Like when we, you know, started working and organizing campaign in South Carolina in 2006, you spent a lot of time working flea markets, which are, you know, working class shopping malls, basically. And we were struck right away at how much evidence there was of current and former, like, interracial coupling, right? But in that place, I mean, what I often mention is one woman, like a grandmother, a white grandmother who looked like she was straight out of the uprising of 34, sitting with her little mixed race black grandbaby, and much greater copious, right? I'm evidence, right, all up and down the working class. And I was reminded that Pitchfork, Ben Tillman and Cole Blees and those guys knew what they were doing, because they understood that when people are in common circumstances, it's as likely that they will align, which is, after all, the thing they'd been frightened to death of since 1865. It's more likely that they'll align on their own than not. So the focal point of politics comes to center on making sure that they don't align, and that's what's coming from the right now too.
So okay, and when you put it in the context of organizing and you, mm-hmm. in a shop, it makes a lot of sense to me, right? You don't come in and highlight any the differences. You highlight, right, shared experiences that everybody's having in there, right, and allow those shared experiences to overcome any type of prejudice or predispositions or racial, right, animus or whatever it is over time.
Right.
But in terms of, like, sort of, you know, the 20,000 foot type of thing, like, where it's not from as an organizing, let's say, tactic, but mm-hmm. in terms of a, I guess, like a sort of broader intellectual fight to mm-hmm. To influence maybe marginally, like, legislation or regulation that will set up, make it easier for you to walk into that shop and mm-hmm. As, like you say, you're in a street fight, you pick up the first thing you see,
right.
And how is it problematic on that level, right? Like, I mean, how is, right, it problematic? I mean, right, frankly, like, when you're talking about, like, organizing a shop, how is it problematic that, like, a New York Times op-ed writer or whomever, you know, mm-hmm. is obscuring this dynamic, at least in that way, as a, you know, or obscuring really what you would do tactically or material, like, in terms of what, right, you do, as opposed to, like, the thoughts, right, associated?
Well, that's important too, Sam. I mean, I'll say a couple things. One is, I do see that Charles Blow gives the Boogaloo Boys bulletin board material at least once every other week. So that doesn't help us. Right. But so I think we're at a point now. Well, the thing is, we got to be able to do both things at the same time. And the problem with whatever that blob is that occupies the cultural space, et cetera, is that it doesn't do that. And it hasn't done that. So much of what is represented as left politics is purely performative and frankly, as a Potemkin quality, right? Like, it's done to affect the cable news cycle, right? Right now, much more than it's done, you know, to try to generate a base and to move people. And there's often a career imperative that's involved as well, right? I mean, just look at the history of Black Lives Matter, for instance, which shouldn't have been that hard to see. Here's the thing. So, like, last summer, I published an article called The Whole Country is a Reichstag in Non-Site. And part of my argument there is that we may well have reached a point at which neoliberalism is no longer capable of delivering enough for enough of the population to sustain its legitimacy as a nominally democratic order. And in that case, what happens is, like, so when I go for a walk here, it's like a T intersection about three blocks from my apartment. So I think about it every day. That we may well be at the political equivalent of a T intersection, where there's only two directions to go. One is right, and that's toward authoritarianism, and the other is at least in a kind of New Dealish social, democratic sensibility that would encourage toward a public good understanding of government. And one of the things that's definitely come through in our work, but I think it comes through from all the anti-vax stuff too, is that working people in this country have pretty much seem to have lost faith in the idea that government can do anything decent for them. And if we don't begin to restore that, right, then it doesn't matter how the public interest groups might get Congress to move or to shift the playing field like two decimal points to the right in our direction, right? Because the right's still going to win, win the game ultimately. And that's why I say we've got to be able to do both things at the same time. You've got to be able to like understand and see. This is why I thought I can never vote for Biden. People are crazy, and I'm irresponsible, and God knows what. Well, I'm no fan of Joe Biden, right? Or the wing of the party that he represents, and it's an odd feeling to think that on domestic policy, the left wing of the Biden administration is represented by Brian Deese and BlackRock, the asset managers. And maybe on foreign policy, the left wing of the Biden administration might be John Mearsheimer.
Yes.
But that's the reality that we have.
There's only two directions. And we should say, to continue that metaphor or that it is also conceivable, people should understand that you could take that authoritarian turn and actually, improve things along the lines of anti-racism, right? Like, I mean, that would be, there would, you could theoretically.
Sure.
Have that guy I was sitting next to. I can't, Von Peebles, was it Peebles or something? That guy I was sitting next to on that show.
Yep.
He could just be like, yeah, no, I mean, we're, and I think at one point, like he did, he started like raising money for Mitt Romney. And after Obama, after the first 4 years, because he didn't get his, it was Don Peebles. And he theoretically, he could be okay in that authoritarian turn as opposed to the right. And there's just nothing being offered on that level, on that plane of decision, essentially, that the nominal left in this country, center to the left as we have it in this country, is offering in a concrete way. I mean, Biden seemed to make an attempt. People could argue as to, how ambitious or how sincere it was, but Build Back Better was at least, providing some of that material support would have gone that way. I mean, I had so much more I wanted to ask you about,
I'm sorry. Like, I'm not letting us talk about the book.
No,
so
no. Well, so, I mean,
this is self-destructive behavior.
But I mean, I think a lot of these themes are sort of embedded in your experience of Jim Crow and the experience of Jim Crow. And we should say, I know you wrote this because you are, essentially the last cohort to have actually lived there. All right. Well, let me just ask one more question that I think will sort of like tie into this too.
Okay.
Is that, you write in the book that in the course of Jim Crow and you have this idea of like, one, obviously you want to keep black people and white people separate because you don't want them saying like, hey, wait a second. Yeah, no, I have trouble making ends meet at the end of the month or this is costing too much. But also that the agenda was not to keep black people separate from the economy, but to play a specific role in that context. Will you speak to that? Because I think that sort of like bridges a little bit of what we've been saying.
Yeah. And frankly, like the view that the point of the segregationist order was to what was to exclude blacks from the society entirely has given over the years given rise to two distinct pathologies. I mean, one of them is the view. The view that the more reasonable course for advocates of black interests, concerns, whatever, through the courts would have been, instead of challenging the legality of separate but equal on 14th Amendment grounds, to focus on demanding strict enforcement of separate but equal doctrine. And I mentioned that in the book. And my point there is that, well, that just fundamentally misunderstands what the point of the regime was, right? The point of the regime, like separate but equal, is never anything more than a fig leaf, right? To get past the 14th and 15th Amendments on paper, to give Northern liberals what would a basis for winking and nodding. The other one is that blacks should secede formally or informally from the main line of the American economy and do their own thing, basically. And that fundamentally what a misunderstands that actually the point of segregation, as was the point of slavery, frankly, was not to separate black people from the economic life of the nation, but was to reduce them to a labor force that had no rights, right? Much in the same way that illegal immigration works today, right? A friend of mine in the workers' center movement, what was often said to white work or to American workers of whatever color, that look, it's not that the immigrants are taking your job. What's happening is that the employer is turning your job into a job that only somebody with no rights or options whatsoever would be eligible for, right? And that's what the point of the Jim Crow system was. And that was one of the, some people call it a tragedy. I don't give them that much credit. But one of the things about the Booker T. Washington line, what was it? He convinced himself, and it was easy to convince himself because he got all the good stuff, that it was possible for blacks to abjure demands for citizenship rights, right? And in the interstices, create a vibrant black business class, basically. Often with fantasies of of all black towns, all black states or whatever. But that fundamentally misunderstands the relation between politics and economics. And just as it did in 1890, it does in 2022.
It just fundamentally misunderstood the fact that like this is not a question of people don't want the white ruling class does not want black people around.
It right. wants them around, but only to right. serve a very specific purpose.
Right, exactly. Right, exactly.
Adolf Reed, the book is called The South, Jim Crow and Its Afterlives. It is, as I have deemed it, an autoethnography.
That's a lot better than memoir, so thank you very much.
Well, I know. I've heard that you don't like that. And so,
no, not at all.
but it is a view at Jim Crow from essentially the ground and mm-hmm. And how it created these circumstances on a daily basis. To achieve a lot of the things that we've been talking about. I really appreciate you coming on today. It was a great pleasure to see you.
Oh, and likewise, I enjoyed the conversation, and thanks a lot for having me.
All right, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Joining us is I'm not sure of his specific title, but he is the leader of the movement Birds.
I'm the public information officer for Birds Aren't Real.
The public information officer for Birds Aren't Real, Peter McIndoe. Peter, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'd like to ask you, before you control the narrative in this conversation, why are you having me on the show? I know you. I looked you up. I Googled you. I know you're with the media. So why do you?
Well,
you have me on your show to laugh at me?
No.
Bringing the bird guy on the show to laugh at him?
No. Not bringing you on to laugh at you, Peter. And honestly, there's no reason for you to be that defensive. Brought you on because this week we did have a writer on talking about who had done a extensive book on people who believe in the flat earth theory. And I thought it might be a good follow-up to have someone on who believes in another theory. And that theory will give you a full opportunity to discuss what that theory is.
I mean, folks, you see how the media does it, you know? You see, I would have preferred maybe to be compared to, hey, look at Guggenheim, who made progressions with the atom, you know? Here's people in history who have done important things. Here's revolutionaries, George Washington. Ever heard of John Adams? But no, I get compared to the flat earth, the people who believe the earth is flat.
Okay. All right. That's a fair critique.
I just want people watching this to see how they do it. They put me up next to the flat earth people and then they have me talk.
Okay. That's a fair critique. I am sorry about that. I will let you, I don't know what controversial, theory that Sam Adams had or John Adams or George.
The idea he had at the time was very controversial. Freedom. That was the name he had. It was very controversial at the time. The times weren't with it. But you know what he did? He went. He stormed the British gates. He had no fear, and he took over and made the United Land of America. And that was controversial at the time. What I'm doing is controversial, but frankly,
I understand. But I mean, to be fair, Peter, like the idea that you're both controversial is not, I think, a fair comparison. He was controversial because he had an opinion and an ideology, but you are making some factual assertions that, and why don't you tell people what those factual assertions are? I mean, there's no reason to be this combative.
Okay. I just know how the establishment lib media works. Okay. I know you and Al Roker and Chris Cuomo and your big establishment buddies are all hanging out, laughing at the little guy. So, you know, I'm not trying to come on combative. I looked you up. I know that you're with the Young Turks. I'm just being cautious. I want to share my ideas. I just, to be quiet, I mean, I don't want to come on your show defensive. I'm sorry. I just
a clip? We can play a clip of. Can we play the clip, please? This is a clip of. You, we can do the one from when you were on television on a local station, or we can do. Yeah, the, here. This is from live, like three. What channel three? Channel three. Where is this channel? Okay. Well, let's just play it.
Consider myself to be an average American. I wake up in the morning, wash my car, and I have an avid disbelief in avian beings.
Maybe you've seen the billboard near the Highland Strip or heard the story on Wednesdays Live at 9. A campaign called Birds Are Not Real brings its efforts to the Mid-South.
And this morning we are joined by one of the messengers of the movement. Peter McIndoe is here to tell us how this all came about. We want to emphasize you were not the founder.
No, ma'am. We put the billboard here because we wanted to bring it to the biggest city in the world, you know, the Paris of the West. So we brought it to Memphis, Tennessee.
From 1959 through 2001, the government mercilessly genocided over 12 billion birds and simultaneously replaced them with surveillance drones in disguise.
Sometimes I'll travel internationally, go to the Himalayas, just to breathe the drone-free air.
So this is really satire. I mean, you don't really believe that that happened, correct? This is a satirical campaign to make the point that what? you're looking at me like, no, it's not satire. I really do believe this.
Honestly, it's kind of offensive.
Okay.
Okay.
We do not find this to be a humorous issue.
Okay. So there it is. There's so your assertion is that the United States government has killed all the birds and replaced them with drones. Is that right?
That's right. And as you can see, I've had some bad experiences with the media, you know? So that's where my defensiveness comes from. I'm often brought on to be laughed at. So just coming on with my guard up. But yeah, that is what our movement stands for, if you really want to know. We talk about how the United States government wiped out 12 billion birds. They extinguished them and whisked them out like a light bulb. And well, they had crop dusting airplanes. I mean, if you really want to get into the facts, people can look this up, and this is not information that you know, the media usually wants out there. So, Sam, thanks for giving the platform. Frankly, a lot of your viewers, I know a lot of you are on YouTube looking for truth like a lot of us. I am too. But the real truth can be found in documents and tapes that only I have access to, along with a couple other people, unfortunately, that reveal that the United States government launched crop dusting airplanes across the United States.
Wait a second. Why do you have access to these documents and only a few other people? Why don't you release these documents?
I mean, these documents were. I mean, we have released some. We released the Poultrygate email leak of early 2021, where huge Hollywood elites, politicians, ever heard of Ted Cruz? Were involved in the bird drone surveillance crisis. It revealed a lot. It revealed that they're hollowing out the mountains around America and putting drone factories inside the hollowed out mountains. Hollywood elites were involved in the making of the drone factories inside the mountains. I don't know if you're familiar with some would say America's greatest renovator named Ty Pennington from Extreme Home Makeover. The United States government consulted him to renovate the insides of most mountains in America, renovate them out and turn them into drone surveillance factories. And if people would turn off their freaking TVs and stop watching these freaking talking heads and actually look into, I mean, the actual research, you know, if you start asking why a couple times, things start falling apart, you know, real quick with the whole bird.
Let me ask, why would you have a drone factory inside a mountain? Why wouldn't you just have it in a drone factory?
Well, you see, Sam, because if you were to have massive bird drone factories with workers out in public, I mean, we're making 12 billion drones here. You know, that's a lot of drones, and that's how many drones.
Don't you need workers in mountains, in the hollowed out mountains? Isn't it workers doing it in the hollowed out mountains? I mean, what difference does it make if it's in a factory or a hollowed out mountain factory?
a lot of land space. I mean, it takes an incredible amount of land mass. I mean, to make one bird drone, it takes, you know, roughly 10 by 10 yards for the machinery required. So we're talking imagine if you hollowed out the Appalachian Mountains, truly, how much land mass there would be under that. You don't think people are tapped into that? Yeah, you don't think some people have stumbled upon doorways? Have you seen the clips? Oh, I went on a little hike. I'm on the side of the mountain. Oops, stumbled upon a doorway. This happens to people all the time. What?
Where can I see the clips of people stumbling onto doorways in the Appalachian Mountains?
Oh, I mean, you have to do your own research. I don't know. I mean, I know you're probably on, you know, the big media websites, but man, there's a lot of great information out there. I really just get my information from birdsaren't real.com because that's the one that I know I can trust. My website, yeah. I do put the information. I mean, it's not my information. I'm the one who goes on Squarespace and puts it on the website, but it's legitimate documents and emails.
You said that's the one place that you go to find information that you trust. You put the information up there.
Yeah, I don't trust anybody but myself.
My understanding is that you are also having a rally that is upcoming, the Media Freedom March.
The Media Freedom March, yeah, it's coming up. We're excited about it. We had a lawsuit against the New York Times that was pretty highly publicized. I launched a full-fledged attack against the New York Times. They released a defamatory story about us. And you know what, Sam? I don't take that lightly. When the media, I'm just saying, man, I'm coming on this show expecting to be bashed. I'm standing in front of you right now, Sam, with 10 flaming arrows in my back. I've had the worst 3 months. The media's come after me from every angle. They're calling us a parody. They're calling us a joke. They're calling me some kind of jokester, and I. You know, I don't think they would do that to any other movement around right now. So we launched lawsuits. We launched lawsuits for libel. That's what you do when you get lied about on a mass platform. I reached out to my lawyers, Mo and Marley at Lieberman and Reese, and we got some stuff together and formally sued CNN and formally sued the New York Times. I was feeling really confident about it. I was feeling really good. But then we got this email from the New York Times General Counsel office that I didn't really understand that kind of brought me down to earth. And we had to retract the lawsuit today, which sucks. But we are redirecting our energy outside of suing the corporation. We placed a curse on the journalist that smeared us. An ancient curse that's going to bring her pain in her life and suffering for generations. And I hope it does cause her a fraction of the suffering she's caused me. Because when you lie about people on the front page of the New York Times, you know what that does to a man? Out in the streets.
Yeah, I can imagine. But I don't think that you are on the front page of the New York Times.
Look it up. See, this is the thing about lib media. This is the thing about the establishment lib media. Hey! If anybody's around the house, can you bring me a copy of the New York Times? They don't do their research. If you look it up, we were on the front page of the New York Times, being blatantly lied.
Who are you calling to bring you a page of the New York Times?
No, I've got some staff around here. We're around an Airbnb where we're organizing. We're doing some plans for the Media Freedom March that's coming up. Because that's the thing. The media comes after you. They smear your name. Okay. How can you fight back? So you sue. You sue them. But then, they have more money and you don't have a case. Oh, you don't even have a case. Blah, 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 you know? And then it goes from that to what else are you supposed to do except take to the streets, Sam? Except get out in the streets And I'm going to bring my van. I'm going to bring my son. And I'm going right to where I know all the media lives, probably where you have a house on this street I hear about over in Hollywood called Hollywood Boulevard.
All right. Well, listen, let me just say I did not realize that there was, in fact, an article, and I apologize.
Thank you.
December 10th, 2021, Section A, page 1. Is this true?
Page 1.
Conspiracy with wings and a wink. Okay. All right. Well, then I stand corrected. I want to make that clear.
Proven wrong once again by the truthers who will continue to tell the truth while the media will lie to you. Folks, I want you to think about this guy you're watching every day. This guy you're watching every day just told you a lie right in front of the guy he's lying about. And then did a good Google search. And I respect you for retracting. I had to retract something today. It happens in life. You know, I had to retract a lawsuit today. It happens. But I just want people to treat us with a bit more respect. And look at this pain and war that I've been brought through in the past 3 months where the entire media is ripping me apart all over the place. Then you try to sue them. You get told that you would actually get sued because you're committing the actual libel. And then, so we're holding a Media Freedom March, a protest on Hollywood Boulevard. We're taking the fight to the media's front door on March 30th at 5:30 Pacific time. And anybody's invited. It's on Hollywood Boulevard. We're going to be out inside of the Chinese Theater. I'm going to be there with my van, and I'm just going to, you know, hey, since they won't let my voice be heard in the courtroom, it'll be heard on the streets. It'll be heard on the streets. I want the streets of Hollywood to shake so much that the letters come tumbling down, the Hollywood sign letters come tumbling down from the hills like an avalanche.
Okay, well, good luck with that. And it's birdsaren'treal.com, is that right?
Birdsaren'treal.com. Come there for the only true sources of information you can find anywhere right now.
Okay. Well, Peter McIndoe, thank you. Thank you for coming on and interesting theory.
Thanks.
All right. It might take a straight black guy to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light's shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made. The option where you don't get paid for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get some.